hello and welcome to CBI at 10. If you're watching or listening wherever you are, it's good to have you here with us with an esteemed lineup of invited experts who are going to help us build on the conversation we had last time about the shortages that are making life particularly challenging for business leaders at the moment. Today's focus is going to be labour shortages, which is something we've talked about a number of times in various different frames in conversations with CBI and its members. Matthew Fell is here, as he often is. Hi, Matthew. Nice to see you. Do you want to just set up today's conversation and particularly how it relates to sort of some of the things we said last time and where we're going to take it?
Thanks, Liz, and hi, everybody. Look, I think in the conversation we had previously around shortages, we identified essentially three buckets of shortages. We've got the challenges around supply chains and what that is doing to constrain materials coming in. We've got a big focus around labour shortages, which we're going to get stuck into today. And then thirdly, we also talked about the energy crisis and the impact that that is having. And just as a quick catch up on that first off, people may have seen over the last few days, CBI, we joined forces with the country's other leading business organisations, the so-called B5, in order to really just put across the fact that actually there's a lot of focus on individual energy bills, rightly so, with the cost of living issues, but also the point out that business is hurting too. So a call for support to help smooth the costs for businesses and to weigh in behind particularly energy intensive industries where other countries are giving greater levels of support and putting the UK at a competitive disadvantage. So just wanted to remind people, Liz, that we're on the case with all of those kind of issues. But then today, I think, look, labour shortages and particularly how D&I can play into that from a big push on diversity and inclusion. Look, firstly, the problems, I think. I mean, I would pick out labour shortage, fairly obviously, they're acting as a real sort of artificial ceiling, if you like, on growth and inhibiting people's ability to sort of take advantage, hopefully, of what will now be a resurgence in demand, for example. So people holding down capacity levels. I've heard restaurants talking about having to choose between doing either lunchtime or evening sittings, for example, because they can't service both. We've all probably in our personal lives experienced sort of longer lead times for skilled trades and things like that. So it's holding down growth. I would also say it's then acting as a bit of a drag on productivity because we haven't been able to deploy firms the skills they need into the right roles, for example. And even if you've got people in, they're getting up to speed and so on. So it's a drag on productivity. And then thirdly, Liz, this thought around the cost of living. Actually, what's happening at the moment is it's feeding a bit of wage inflation because everybody is chasing the same kind of skills and the same kind of people, and there's not enough to go around. And that's acting as a bit of a squeeze, particularly, I think, for small and medium-sized companies who are then struggling to compete on wages. So it's sort of thinking, what else can we do to help? And that's where the guide, the CBI, the checklist that we put out about how do you go about addressing some of these issues, hopefully will help people. Put a reminder of that in the chat again. But particularly today, we think that a big focus on diversity and inclusion can really help with this.
Thanks ever so much, Matthew. I'm really looking forward to digging into this a bit with Mary and Katrina and Lindsay, because you're all three of you people who are actively and purposefully doing stuff to make a difference now. I think sometimes when we have culture change conversations, that can sometimes feel like it's the frame for diversity and inclusion. It feels sort of a bit sit back. You know, we want to change, we want to work on it, but we know it's a long game and what have you. But labour shortages are very real. They are here today. And I'm very keen to hear from you practical things that employers and potential employers can do now that can really help unpick some of these challenges. So Mary, let me come to you first, if I may. You're head of social affairs at Phoenix Group, and you also wear another hat, don't you, in your job?
Yes. So our group chief executive, Andy Briggs, is the government business champion for older workers, a role he took up 5 years ago, and I'm his age special advisor. So within this diversity, inclusion and equality piece, I have a particular age lens because age exacerbates every other form of protected characteristic and is universal to all of us.
Let's go straight for the jugular, if you like. What different types of diversity and inclusion strategies are available in your sort of pick list of things that you might do if you're particularly looking at a labour shortage? What are the levers that you can pull?
The traditional way of looking at it is the attract, recruit, retain, retrain. And I think all of those are absolutely relevant to the situation we've got now. So if we take the transition to net zero and the gas fitters we have who need to become heat pump engineers, that's a workforce that is there, that is skilled, that needs retraining. If we look at recruitment, according to the Institute for Employment Studies, there are around 1 million people over the age of 50 who could be in work who aren't. So that attract and recruitment piece, and people talk about B&Q as being a role model for good at recruiting older workers. And the reason they were successful is they said they wanted them.
Simple as that.
If it were that simple, we could wave a magic wand, but make people feel wanted. And that's about your imagery, checking that on your website you have grey hair or no hair, checking that your language isn't unconsciously signalling young, enthusiastic, innovative. And yet we know that entrepreneurs who have startups over the age of 50 are more likely to succeed than those under. Your coding using innovative is saying young, but the reality is if you're innovative at 25, you're innovative at 55, it's just you've learned, you have more experience, right? So that's about recruitment, attraction, recruitment, retention, investing in your people, adapting. I love talking about menopause, about carers. One in four women think about leaving the workplace because of menopause. 600 people leave the workforce every day because of caring responsibilities. We've rightly spent a lot of time and focus thinking about women and maternity since the 1970s. That's been a battle that we've been facing. We now have 30% of the workforce over 50. So we really need to think about the employee-friendly policies that we have in place to enable retention. So attract, recruit, retain, retrain, and that covers your basis of good employment regardless of characteristic.
Thanks ever so much, Mary. I might come back to you in a second, because there's been a lot of coverage recently about practical things that employers need to do to support women who are in the phase of their life when the menopause is happening to them. So we might come talk about some practical things there. Lindsay Simpson. Hi, Lindsay. I want to pick up on this language point in a second, but just briefly tell us who you are and why you're here.
Yeah, of course. So 55 Redefined, the UK's champion for today's over 50, entrepreneurial, energetic, loving life, modern demographic. We've added 30 years to life expectancy over the last century, and the group of people that are currently in the age range 50 to 75 are younger minded, healthier, more active, and have a very different mentality to work and life than their parents' generation. But nothing else around them has moved. So state pension age has shifted ever so slightly. Employer policies haven't been updated. And this mindset of three-stage life of education, work, retirement kind of hasn't really moved on. So we're there supporting both individuals that are over 50 to find work, retrain, buy a franchise, do exciting things in this stage of life. But we're also providing practical and real solutions for employers to do exactly what Mary said. So how do you attract this audience when their LinkedIn profile says retired or they're not on job boards? You know, how do you recruit them when we know that 39% of recruiters are less likely to even consider a candidate over 50 than a recruiter that's in their 40s, for example? Mm-hmm. How do you then engage them and retrain them when we know factually that only 35% of employers are prepared to retrain over 50s into their organisation? And then how do you retain them when we know that we have a demographic and socioeconomic issue, which is a shrinking workforce? You know, the group of people aged 16 to 64 in this country will shrink by 25%. And in the same period of time, the group of people over 65 will grow by 40%. So unless we start mentally adding another 10 years onto work life, but changing what work life means. So it's not just I work a really crazy another 10 years full time and then kill myself at the end of it. And that's what we're kind of starting the conversation around and helping employers go, what does that mean? How do we re-educate? How do we get rid of this bias? And how do we do stuff that practically enables us to, as Matthew quite, you know, rightly pointed out, grow, you know, because if you've got a shrinking age workforce, then, and you want to grow as an organisation, then you have to find a way of embracing new forms of talent and different and diverse groups of people to equip your organisation to grow.
Lindsay, it's really fascinating. And as you and Mary have spoken, I have been having a live shame over because I am currently recruiting for a role to work with me. It's a fixed term contract role. And I'm thinking about the language I've used on my LinkedIn post to say this role is open. And I'm also noticing that the person, the sort of silhouette of the person at the moment is an empty gap that I've imagined is a young person doing this job because it's quite a junior position. So some of my own bias is because I equate older with expensive.
Exactly.
What else do people get wrong?
Well, and you're quite right. So, and to give you the facts, I mean, obviously, we commission a huge amount of independent research on this topic to really understand ageism at work and find out why, so we can kind of break that down. But 92% of workers in their mid-50s and beyond are prepared to take a salary cut to reskill or learn a new industry and role. The biggest reason that they leave workforce is that they are bored. It's the biggest reason. It's that they don't want to just keep doing the same thing and no one will consider them to do anything different, be it more junior, less money. You know, I do a number of podcasts on this and, you know, because I'm just trying to bring to life real people doing real things. And, you know, Phil Goddard, who was earning six figures in the telecoms industry in a sales role, decided age 56 he wanted to be a postman. You know, he'd gained a couple of stone doing video calls through the pandemic, didn't need the money anymore, but wanted to work, wanted to meet people, wanted to talk to customers again. And the efforts to convince, you know, just Royal Mail that, you know, he can get up in the morning when it's dark and cold and raining, and that he isn't going to give up. And why would he want to take such a salary cut? Why would he want to do this? Everybody's so distrusting of people. And fast forward 6 months, you know, he's doing 20,000 steps a day, he's lost a load of weight, he's loving life, talking to people, and he can convincibly see that this could be his life for the next 20 years, and he's delighted with that. You know, Lucy Kellaway, you know, renowned FT journalist, you know, decided she wanted to retrain and be a maths teacher, and she's going through secondary school education. Again, everyone's like, but why would you want to do that? It's a massive salary cut, it's less ego. The drivers that we have in our 20s, 30s and 40s around career progression, around earnings, around providing for our family, shift significantly as you progress into your 50s, your 60s and 70s. Mm. So you become less about the financial return. It becomes more about doing interesting things that you have a passion around. It becomes more about learning new skills and new industries. And as Mary called out, there is also the very real situation that this generation of 50 plus are the sandwich generation between three others. So they have caring responsibility for elderly parents in their 80s, 90s and beyond. They still have children that they're looking out for, but they then also have grandchildren on the scene that they're being expected to provide, you know, caring cover for as well. But they want to work. And so finding a way where, you know, we can kind of support people to just live life longer. That piece around, you know, I suppose, Liz, to just summarise this. So, you know, employers assume people won't take pay cuts. Employers wrongly assume and are cynical around taking role positional drops and just assume, you know, that that isn't, you know, an appropriate or there's an underlying reason that makes them bad as to why they'd want to go backwards. And then there is a range of other big stereotypes. The two biggest, well, the three biggest ones we hear are, first is they're more likely to get ill. The last 2 years of a pandemic where the papers have just been, if you're over 50, you're vulnerable, haven't helped people's subconscious bias, you know, disassociate with that. So the reality is somebody in their mid-50s is 200% less likely to take a day off work sick than somebody in their 20s. That's the fact. They are not more likely to get ill. Second one is they lack energy and pace. Again, nothing to do with age. You know, you can have a 20-year-old that lacks energy and pace and you can have a 60-year-old that lacks energy and pace and vice versa. It is a behavioural characteristic, not an age-related one. And the third one that drives us all nuts is they don't have digital skills. So, and Liz, maybe, you know, the role that you're hiring yourself, I don't know whether that's a digital role, but we have, you know, the advertising industry, the digital industry, the media industry is driven to youth, despite the fact that you know, there are companies that need experience. You know, if you're a really young fintech business and you're staffed with great, bright minds straight out of uni for your technology, and you try and work with one of the UK's banks where you're plugging into green screens, Python and technology that was built 40 years ago, be quite helpful to have somebody who knows what that technology does. And so having a mix of people, you know, my CTO, I'm a tech business, he's 67 and he's, you know, an absolute powerhouse of trends and technology. So these are just all misconceptions that employers hold. And we as a collective just need to find ways to start knocking out some of these stereotypes and making real change.
Thanks ever so much, Lindsay. I can see Katrina smiling and nodding along as Lindsay talks. Now, Katrina Campbell, your client technology and chief client technology and information officer, it's a bit of a mouthful, sorry, for EY UK and Ireland. Tell us about what you're doing in general in this space. You've come at it with a slightly different lens, but it's very much about tackling a misconception, isn't it?
Diversity, equity and inclusion is the fabric of our culture here at EY. And we work hard to sustain that kind of environment for the people and make sure that they feel empowered to bring their authentic selves to work. One of the things that we are doing in this very, very hot labour market, and the reason that I've been selected today to be on this panel, is I represent the technology and innovation agenda. And the severe labour shortage that we have in the UK right now for data scientists, for data engineers, for technology engineers and innovation leads. And so what we did was we looked at the very severe labour shortage, and we thought to ourselves, where can we find an untapped quality number of individuals to help us? So as part of our working culture, we represent a very good employer for neurodiverse employees. And so what we did was we effectively went to our talent team. We said, listen, help us recruit into our innovation and technology function some more neurodiverse characteristics. So let me just explain very briefly, if I may, what neurodiverse means for the audience in case they're not familiar with it. So neurodiversity includes people with ADD, ADHD, dyscalculia, dyspraxia, dyslexia, and autism. And what we're finding is that there is an incredibly talented market out there. And so tapping into that market is exactly what we've been doing. Last week, we launched our first neurodiversity centre of excellence in Manchester, which we estimate will grow to 150 people. And that centre of excellence is all around innovation. And what we did was we employed experienced and grads, individuals into that centre. And why into that centre? Well, it's a different recruitment process. We've amended our recruitment processes to make sure that our neurodiverse colleagues feel at ease with the recruitment process. So it may well be that the standard interview procedure may not be suitable. So what we did was we tweaked our recruitment process for those individuals to make it a 4-day simulation. So what would it be like to work with EY? So over 4 days, those candidates came into our process, learned how they could work from home flexibly, how they could work with the technology that they feel comfortable within. And so those people worked with us for 4 days. And what we did was we had a huge amount of applicants. We recruited more than we'd intended to, actually. We've now got these individuals working with us in our Manchester centre and absolutely loving it. And LinkedIn just exploded with fabulous positive comments about, great, you've tweaked the recruitment process, great that you're being so inclusive, but also great that we've found this incredibly untapped labour market for us for technology and innovation. So yeah, so that's why I'm here today, to talk about that underrepresented. We think 20% of the UK society has neurodivergent traits, and only 22% of autistic adults are in any form of employment in the UK, according to Made by Dyslexia UK. So we aim to change that. We aim to employ more neurodivergent employees who can help both our clients and our own teams become innovative and think differently.
Super fascinating. Thanks, Katrina. So we've mentioned a little bit how you can and should adjust the content of the advert, the content of the job advert, the words you use, being explicit to Mary's point about saying we want to employ people with these characteristics. That's one thing. Katrina's talked about how we need to adapt the recruitment process. I wonder if we might talk a bit about the job itself then, and how or whether changes can or should be made to the actual work itself to make it more feasible, more welcoming, and ultimately get those really exciting retention figures that you can get, Katrina. How can you sort of manoeuvre those things?
Well, we talked about retraining earlier, and it's fair to say that across our business, we are supporting our employees retrain. We've created a platform called our Digital Badges Program. So existing employees are supported to do lifelong learning here at EY, and they can pull down the badge content, create their badges, and work through their badges program. And every single employee around the world, there's 400,000 people work for EY globally, every single one of those employees is invited to do those badges, which ultimately will end in a tech MBA, a free MBA for every single employee in EY. Just phenomenal. So I've been in this firm for close to 5 years, and I'm partway through that journey, and I cannot wait to get my tech MBA, along with a whole manner of other employees who've never worked in technology for us before and who now will, with those internal qualifications and that externally validated MBA from Hult International Business School. So we're retraining our staff. And I think that what's, you know, really exciting about that is that's not just, you know, the neurodiverse employees that I mentioned earlier. That's all employees across EY can retrain, can upskill with that badges program.
Mary, in your organisation, you sort of have multiple frames of reference for your job. You think about the Phoenix Group employees and how you can affect that, as well as doing sort of more external policy work and obviously product design, consumer requirements and stuff like that too. Thinking about the first of those, the how you've affected the experience and the diversity of talent you have inside of your business, just talk us through some of the practical things. You mentioned, obviously, the language in the job advertisements. Katrina's talked about skilling and training. Give us some more examples of things that you've done that you've seen make a material difference to your ability to attract and retain talent.
So I think about this, I guess, from where Lindsay started, that broadly we have a model of employment from the last century. So what does good employment look like in a very inclusive way? And we know that the number one search for term on most recruitment is flexible work. And if you want to fish in 100% of the talent pool, you need to remove any of those barriers to entry to people even applying. So take away the barrier of, can I work part-time because I need to do XYZ or because I want to do XYZ. Take away the expectation for men, for women, for people of colour, just remove that straight away. Look at the breakdown of your existing workforce and listen to them. Ask them what they want, because they will tell you that they are struggling with not having the right adaptive technology, not having the right workplace environment for their neurodiversity, not having a space to pray, and so not feeling included. And so really, you know, we have 9 different employee resource groups, and we listen to those and consult with them and say, what will make a difference to you? What do you need? Mm-hmm. Each executive team sponsors one of those and really works closely with them, say, these are the things that will make a difference and these are the things we need to do. I talked about menopause earlier, about for the 50% of the UK population who are female, those two things are more likely to be a factor. So one in four women think about leaving the workplace because of menopause. And we really need to raise our game around that. We've introduced training for everybody, training for line managers, menopause ambassadors. So it's not just something you're expected to know about. Over 30 ways that menopause can present at work. Lots of people don't know that. I speak to people and say, oh, actually, maybe I'm experiencing menopause transition. So we have these ambassadors embedded across the organisation to start those conversations and to flag the training that's available.
Lindsay, I've just seen, I think my machine has just refreshed, but there's a ton of brilliant questions that I want to pick out and some comments and things. Lindsay, one here that I wonder if you've come across, or Katrina, if you have too, from Arshad Elahi, who's asked a question. We mentioned before about being explicit about saying, these are the types of people that I want to recruit. But we all have also sort of for some years been almost encouraged never to do that for fear of it being discriminatory in another way. So what Arshad is asking, I was trying to create an insight day for ethnic minorities, but I was told it would come across as positive discrimination. How do you sort of manage that? I remember Mary saying, you know, B&Q went out of their way to say we want to recruit people who are this age. Is that okay to do?
So you're quite right. And there is a lot of confusion around discrimination and what you can and can't do. The key is what you can't do is exclude anybody. So what you can do is positively promote and encourage different forms of talent to apply to you. So in the case of that question, you could absolutely, you could post roles, you could invite people on ethnic minority groups on Facebook, you could skew your posters in ethnic minority dense areas. So let's say Leicester, for example. So the imagery that you have for your campaign in Leicester might be very different to your imagery for your campaign in Canterbury or Glasgow, where you're trying to attract different groups of people. The key is that you go broad. So you can't just say, I'm only looking for this characteristic. But what you can do is encourage that characteristic and this characteristic and this characteristic. And that's what we try and do. You know, when we set up 55 Redefined job board, it was due to my huge frustration, having been in the recruitment industry for, you know, 13 years, that when age became a protected characteristic, it just meant a higher miss rate. It just meant that older candidates were going into the process. Nobody knew the age of them, but they still ended up meeting a hiring manager that didn't want to hire that age of person. And everybody's time's wasted because nobody can have just the conversation around the profile of people that they want. The same is happening around retention. So because you can no longer encourage retirement or force retirement, employers don't know how to broach the question of retirement, and employees are feeling unsupported about how to ask about flexibility when they're an existing employee of that age group, because they don't want to put their head above the parapet and show that they're no longer interested or passionate or ambitious, because they do want to go down to 4 days a week or 3 days a week. So we do need the help of policy, of governments and employers to find some safe ways, really, for everybody to just stop dancing around handbags and actually have some adult conversations. One thing I will raise here is something I did a bit of a rant on LinkedIn the week before Christmas, and it went nuts, you know, 100,000 views, comments, absolutely nuts. And I called out something that I hear every day and have heard every day now for probably about 5 years, but no one is prepared to call it out, which is the most discriminated group I hear, actively discriminated, is white middle-aged men. You know, and it's a very unpopular thing for me to say. It's something that Matthew or a white middle-aged man don't feel that they can say, because they'll be told that they're entitled and everything else. But you know, you would never say to a black female candidate, I'm sorry, I can't put you on my shortlist because you don't meet my diversity criteria. But every day of the week, white middle-aged men are told that they can't make even first base into a recruitment process because the employer is only interested in recruiting niche D&I characteristics, and they're specifically looking for a female candidate, or they're looking for somebody with a niche characteristic. So there is active discrimination out there, and people think that that's acceptable because nobody's kind of talking about it. But our view is inclusion. So, you know, what we need to get across to our teams that are on the front line doing recruitment in our organisations, or doing HR or controlling learning and development, is yes, of course, you want to promote and improve underrepresented groups in your organisation. But that isn't at the expense. It's not that good recruitment equals this and bad recruitment equals that, which is how it's currently being applied. It's that inclusive means everybody. So when you're doing your talent attraction, when you're doing recruitment advertising, when you're writing your job descriptions, you're trying to reach all of those audiences specifically, but inclusively, that everybody's welcome.
And thanks ever so much, Lindsay. I will look up your LinkedIn rant with great interest. Katrina, you're a senior person in a huge company, and in your case, particularly being involved in championing the inclusion of and recruitment of more people with neurodiverse characteristics makes a huge difference to have somebody who, like you, who really cares and gets it by the scruff of the neck and who can make change happen. Another question that's come in from people watching live is whether the sort of other way, the bottom-up way, the sort of employee-led championing groups and working groups and things can really be effective, or if they just make people feel good, but actually if you don't have the air cover of somebody senior driving the agenda, you sort of kind of wasting your time in a nice way.
We've got some incredible groups across EY, and they are absolutely driving change and have done for years. You know, we've got an incredibly diverse, very, very inclusive set of champions, and most of them are led by our chairman, Howell Ball. So it starts at the very top. So higher than me, Liz. Howell is part of, he's the champion of our race network groups. He's the champion of our a whole bunch of different groups across EY, as you say, a really large organization. We are an incredibly inclusive organization, always have been, and I think our clients expect that. So we were 20,000 clients in the UK. We work with an inordinate amount of small to large organisations. So they expect us to deliver the very best. So although we have a very long-standing priority for all of those groups across EY, you're right. It does take that chairman. It does take that top-down leadership, as well as the grassroots organisations, to shift that change. And I think if you come at it from both, then you really can make substantial difference. So when I go back to the Neurodiversity Centre of Excellence for a moment, we've always employed neurodiverse colleagues. I set up this centre purely because we needed more technologists, and it was an untapped labour market within the technologist domain. But we've always been incredibly measured with our recruitment, experienced hires and grads and apprentices. In fact, last year we had 65,000 applicants for jobs here, 65,000, which is incredible. We could only offer 1,000, but quite a phenomenal amount of people wanting to apply to EY. One of the things I think makes us successful is that inclusive policy, but also the things that we stand for, purpose. Our strapline is building a better working world, and we have a huge focus at the moment on sustainability. So, you know, along with lifelong learning, and I mentioned the MBA, it's all about purpose for us. And I think we're doing, yeah, grassroots, we're doing a great job, as well as top down from Howell.
This is a slight aside, but I am from Yorkshire, and I have a badge that sits on my coat that says A up on it, EY up. And everywhere I go, such is EY's reputation for being an inclusive employer, they think it's my badge from my kind of inclusion program at EY that I work for. So I did that whole chat about employer brand and reputation.
It
takes a bit of time, but I think it really makes a difference, because I think you're right in the EY does. Really got
just
that.
Just a quick vignette, the reason that I'm here and at EY is because I have my own agency. I started a business when I was 26, a technology design business, grew it. London, Paris, Riyadh, Dubai, and then sold it to EY in 2015, and then joined EY. Now, there is no way I would have sold to anyone other than EY, because they were adamant they would look after us, they would grow the business, they would support the employees. And it really was, there was a whole load of suitors to buy the agency, but it absolutely was the right cultural fit. And that's why I'm still here. You don't often hear about entrepreneurs who've sold up and stick around, and I'm not going anywhere. So Lindsay, I'll be here till I'm 70. If they'll have me.
So just one of the things I was going to say around that point around grassroots up, it does create, what you do need, you need top and the bottom to instigate the change. So a good example of that is around ethnicity. So I'm going to use that case there. So if I roll the clock back about 5-10 years in this country, if my name was Sahela, and I, you know, was from, you know, an ethnic background, I would feel that if I joined a Western UK company, I'd have to shorten my name to Sue, because people struggle to say Sahela or spell Sahela. And so I was adapting myself to be more acceptable. Equally, on my CV, I would call myself Sue, and because I would think I'd be discriminated against if I called myself Sahela. That feedback that came from grassroots up groups to organisations and then was heard at chair level has created real change. And I think that, you know, that level of people being able to bring themselves to work without having to adapt to the organisation is important. The bit I would flag to employers on the call, if they're from a HR or recruitment persuasion or from a leadership persuasion, is the challenge we have with all of these diversity groups that we're talking about, be that age, be that disability, be that neurodiversity, is you can get it right at the top. You know, I see a lot of organisations that I talk to get it right at the top in terms of their ambition. They can then get it right at the bottom. So they can get it right in terms of their recruitment processes, their attraction strategy, you know, their ways of working. And then where it all falls down is that bit in the middle. A good example of a big FMCG provider that particularly wanted to attract ethnic minorities into their production units. And they did a great campaign. They changed all their recruitment processes and they onboarded a huge number of people from different ethnic backgrounds, and then they all left within 3 months. And the reason being is that in the manufacturing plants, prayers were not acceptable. Having a prayer space, having being able to take breaks at certain time for prayers was just not the done thing, and so they all left. And so you do have to think, you know, and if I talk about age, which is obviously my passion pillar, that's the one that I'm trying to drive change around, you know, I'm seeing and working with some fabulous recruitment teams that are getting older candidates right in the pipe. They're getting them in, but there are hiring managers that then feel intimidated having somebody come and work for them that is 20, 30 years more experienced than them, and they don't know how to deal with it. They don't know whether they want their job. They don't understand if they're going to be shown up through their lack of experience. They don't know how to manage them because they have such different motivators and drivers. They don't get them, and so they don't hire them. So again, you know, educating the people within our business around how to work with multi-generational teams and how that they do have very different values and drivers is just as important as fixing the funnel coming into the organisation.
Thanks, Lindsay. I'm going to come back to Mary and pick up on a couple of comments that have come in on my screen from Joanna Collis and Tom Hadley. How much, and I feel this in my own experience, how much do you think there is real appetite for a full and wholesale recruitment revolution? And the packaging of that question relates to the sort of persistence of companies to seem to want to ask for people to have a degree, the sort of stubborn biases we've spoken about somebody's used the phrase, all my managers want is people on an upward trajectory, which sort of tends to skew, you know, one way and perhaps talk to a certain kind of educational background. I'm just interested to know whether you think that all of this great work and good ideas, and I believe there are pockets of real sort of effort and change, adds up to something that looks like a genuine shift and the sort of openness and willingness to accept people from what might be considered non-traditional backgrounds or different sectors and those kinds of things. Do you think we are getting to the stage where that's starting to happen, or not really? Is this still quite piecemeal?
I'm hugely optimistic that through this labour market crisis, which is what we're talking about, that we may get to the point where we move from here's the great theory and I buy it intellectually to I've heard the practice and now I'm really going to do it because I have to. And that is our opportunity to create the tipping point. And so do I think it's there? Not yet. The number of people who signed up to this webinar, the work that the CBI and other organisations have been doing to put that good practice out there has laid the groundwork. I believe that the leaders across industry absolutely get it. They know that diverse and inclusive businesses deliver better results. That's the bottom line. We've got challenges there. We've got challenges in some of the growth groups feeling wanted. And when I look at Birmingham, where we have a large office, we don't have sufficient Black and minority ethnic representation. We talk to those groups, they haven't thought about us. So we've got work to do to attract and to make a really inclusive workplace. And I think that is the flip part. It's where we need to get to next. I think inclusion will be our next challenge. We've focused on diversity for the last number of years with increasing understanding of different characteristics. We've got to get to diversity, inclusion, and equality of opportunity. We've got the demand in the labour market, and we need to capitalise on that.
Let's hope that necessity is indeed the mother of invention. Matthew, we've got a minute left, and I know you wanted to just say a couple of things before we close.
Yeah, well, Liz, just pulling the threads together from this conversation, I think, firstly, Mary is right. Look, we've got a new imperative to act, actually. You know, previously, I think people either bought into this as it drove company performance, which the stats absolutely sort of bear that out, or they believe it was totally the right thing to do, which, of course, it is. But I think now there is that extra burning platform that we're really struggling to get people into roles and so on. So there's that imperative to act. I think the second thing that's going on is actually we're broadening out the way we think about diversity and inclusion. You know, I think lots of companies started out with gender diversity as a sort of sensible place to start because they needed to get hold of something and to bite it off. Then they probably broaden it out to ethnic diversity. And we've heard through this conversation, there's just so many more avenues to really sort of get up to speed on and get across. So I think that broadening out is happening. And then I think the practical steps that companies can take, we've heard about in the conversation too, Liz, about, you know, work through a set of things, segment out what are you doing on recruitment, and then what are you doing on retention to keep people within the business. There are different actions you can take within each of those on retention, getting the pitch and your language right, making sure you make adjustments in the interview process, embracing hybrid, flexible, remote working, publishing your D&I credentials and so on, because people scrutinize you on that. And then on the retention side, thinking about your employee value proposition that actually appeals to these parts of the workforce, thinking about more flexible models, the ideas that companies have been having, the midlife skills MOTs and things like that. So those, I think, Liz, is the sort of way we think about it, imperative to act, broaden it out, think about your recruitment, think about your retention. Those are some really important practical steps I think companies can take. And then just to close, Liz, just as a reminder, look, this shortages thing, we said right at the start, there's no silver bullet on this. So we've got coming up in a couple of weeks' time, how you can think about sort of job design and attractiveness to sort of help tackle the issue. Thinking about tech adoption, another session on that we've got coming up in a couple of weeks. But next week, we've got a little bit of an interlude just to give people a heads up. We've got a major intervention, Tony Danker, our Director General, talking about going for growth and a big CBI intervention a week today. So do look out for that. And we'll be back to tackle the shortages debate in 2 weeks' time.
Thanks very much, everybody. It's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you to Katrina, to Lindsay, to Mary, and as always, to Matthew. Whether you've watched live or whether you're listening wherever you are, that's it from us. Go put the kettle on before you dive back into your emails and have a good rest of the day, however much there is left of it. All the best. Bye-bye.